go to. She missed the crowding and the companionship of the markets very much. During several of her marriages, she had been a great trader. The produce of her garden and the pottery and tools she created were always very fine. Her goats and fowls were always fat. Now there was nothing. Not even sickness to heal or gods to call upon. Both the slaves and the crew seemed remarkably healthy. She had seen no diseases but what Doro called seasickness among the slaves, and that was nothing. In her boredom, Anyanwu accepted Isaac's companionship. But now she could see that it was time to stop. It was wrong to torment the boy. She was pleased, though, to realize that he saw beauty in her even now, smothered as she was in so much cloth. She had feared that to eyes other than Doro's, she would look ridiculous. "Thank you for these things," she said softly in English. "They make you even more beautiful," he told her. "I am like a prisoner, all bound. You'll get used to it. Now you can be a real lady." Anyanwu turned that over in her mind. "Real lady?" she said, frowning. "What was I before?" Isaac's face went red. "I mean, you look like a New York lady." His embarrassment told her that he had said something wrong, something insulting. She had thought she was misunderstanding his English. Now she realized she had understood all too well. "Tell me what I was before, Isaac," she insisted. "And tell me the word you used before, civilization. What is civilization?" He sighed, met her eyes after a moment of gazing past her at the main mast. "Before you were Anyanwu," he said. "Mother of I don't know how many children, priestess to your people, respected and valued woman of your town. But to the people here, you would be a savage, almost an animal if they saw you wearing only your cloth. Civilization is the way one's own people live. Savagery is the way foreigners live." He smiled tentatively. "You're already a chameleon, Anyanwu. You understand what I'm saying." "Yes." She did not return his smile. "But in a land where most of the people are white, and of the few blacks, most are slaves, can only a few pieces of cloth make me a real lady?" "In Wheatley I can," he said quickly. "I'm white and black and Indian, and I live there without trouble."
"But you look like a real man."
He winced.
"I'm not like you," he said. "I can't help the way I look."
"No," she admitted.
"And it doesn't matter anyway. Wheatley is Doro's American village. He dumps all the people he can't find places for in his pure families on us. Mix and stir. No one can afford to worry about what anyone else looks like. They don't know who Doro might mate them with, or what their own children might look like."
Anyanwu allowed herself to be diverted.
"Do people even marry as he says?" she asked. "Does no one resist him?"
Isaac gave her a long, solemn look.
"Wild Seed resists sometimes," he said softly. "But he always wins. Always."
She said nothing. She did not need to be reminded of how dangerous and how demanding Doro could be. Reminders awakened her fear of him, her fear of a future with him. Reminders made her want to forget the welfare of her children, whose freedom she had bought with her servitude. Forget and run.
"People run away sometimes," Isaac said, as though reading her thoughts. "But he always catches them, and usually wears their bodies back to their hometowns, so that their people can see and be warned. The only sure way to escape him and cheat him out of the satisfaction of wearing your body, I guess, is my mother's way."
He paused. "She hanged herself." Anyanwu stared at him.
He had said the words with no particular feeling, as though he cared no more for his mother than he had for his brother Lael. And he had told her he could not remember a time when he and Lael had not hated each other.
"Your mother died because of Doro?"
she asked, watching him carefully. He shrugged.
"I don't know, really. I was only 4. But I don't think so. She was like Lael, able to send and receive thoughts, but she was better at it than he was, especially better at receiving. From Wheatley, sometimes she could hear people in New York City over 150 miles away."
He glanced at Anyanwu.
"A long way. A damned long way for that kind of thing. She could hear anything, but sometimes she couldn't shut things out. I remember I was afraid of her. She used to crouch in a corner and hold her head or scratch her face bloody and scream and scream and scream."
He shuddered.
"That's all I remember of her. That's the only image that comes when I think of her."
Anyanwu laid a hand on his arm in sympathy for both mother and son. How could he have come from such a family and remained sane himself, she wondered. What was Doro doing to his people, to his own children, in his attempt to make them more as the children of his own lost body might have been? For each one like Isaac, how many were there like Lael and his mother?
"Isaac, has there been nothing good in your life?" she asked softly.
He blinked.
"Well, there's been a lot. Doro, the foster parents he found me when I was little, the travel, this."
He rose several inches above the deck.
"It's been good. I used to worry that I'd be crazy like my mother or mad dog vicious like Lael, but Doro always said I wouldn't. How could he know? He used a different body to father me. He wanted a different ability in me, and sometimes he knows exactly which families to breed together to get what he wants. I'm glad he knew for me."
She nodded.
"I would not want to know you if you were like Lael."
He looked down at her in that intense, disturbing way he had developed over the voyage, and she took her hand away from his arm. No son should look at his father's wife that way. How stupid of Doro not to find a good girl for him. He should marry and begin fathering yellow-haired sons. He should be working his own farm. What good was sailing back and forth across the sea, taking slaves, and becoming wealthy when he had no children? In spite of slight faltering winds, the trip upriver to Wheatley took only 5 days. The Dutch sloop captains and their Dutch-speaking black slave crews peered at the sagging sails, then at each other, clearly frightened. Doro complimented them in pretended ignorance on the fine time they were making. Then in English, he warned Isaac, "Don't frighten them too badly, boy. Home isn't that far away." Isaac grinned at him and continued to propel the sloops along at exactly the same speed. Cliffs, hills, mountains, farmland and forests, creeks and landings, other sloops and smaller craft, fishermen, Indians. Doro and Isaac, having little to do as passengers on other men's vessels, entertained Anyanwu by identifying and pronouncing in English whatever caught her interest. She had an excellent memory, and by the time they reached Wheatley, she was even exchanging a few words with the Afro-Dutch crew. She was beautiful, and they taught her eagerly until Doro or Isaac, or their duties, took her from them. Finally, they reached Gilpin, as the captains and crews called the village of Wheatley. Gilpin was the name given to the settlement 60 years before by its first European settlers, a small group of families led by Peter Willem Gilpin. But the English settlers whom Doro had begun bringing in well before the 1664 British takeover had renamed the village Wheatley, wheat being its main crop, and Wheatley being the name of the English family whose leadership Doro had supported. The Wheatleys had been Doro's people for generations. They had vague, not too troublesome, mind-reading abilities that complemented their good business sense. With a little help from Doro, old Jonathan Wheatley now owned slightly less land than the Van Rensselaers. Doro's people had room to spread and grow. Without the grassland village, they would not grow as quickly as Doro had hoped, but there would be others, odd ones, witches. Dutch, German, English, various African and Indian peoples, all were either good breeding stock or, like the Wheatleys, served other useful purposes. In all its diversity, Wheatley pleased Doro more than any of his other New World settlements. In America, Wheatley was his home. Now, welcomed with quiet pleasure by his people, he dispersed the new slaves to several separate households. Some were fortunate enough to go to houses where their native languages were spoken. Others had no fellow tribesmen in or around the village, and they had to be content with a more alien household. Relatives were kept together. Doro explained to each individual or group exactly what was happening. All knew they would be able to see each other again. Friendships begun during the voyage did not have to end now. They were apprehensive, uncertain, reluctant to leave what had become a surprisingly tight-knit group, but they obeyed Doro. Lael had chosen them well, had handpicked every one of them, searching out small strangenesses, buddings, beginnings of talents like his own. He had gone through every group of new slaves brought out of the forest to Bernard daily while Doro was away, gone through picking and choosing and, doubtless, terrifying people more than was necessary. No doubt, he had missed several who could have been useful. Lael's ability had been limited, and his erratic temperament had often gotten in his way, but he had not included anyone who did not deserve to be included. Only Doro himself could have done a better job. And now, until some of his other potentially strong young thought readers matured, Doro would have to do the job himself. He did not seek people out as Lael did, deliberately, painstakingly. He found them almost as effortlessly as he had found Anyanwu, though not from as great a distance. He became aware of them as easily as a wolf became aware of a rabbit when the wind was right. And in the beginning, he had gone after them for exactly the same reason wolves went after rabbits. In the beginning, he had bred them for exactly and the same reason people bred rabbits. These strange ones, his witches, were good kills. They offered him the most satisfying, durable food and shelter. He still preyed on them. Soon, he would take one from Wheatley. The people of Wheatley expected it, accepted it, treated it as a kind of religious sacrifice. All his towns and villages fed him willingly now, and the breeding projects he carried on among them entertained him as nothing else could. He had brought them so far, from tiny, blind, latent talents to Lael, to Isaac, and even, in a roundabout way, to Anyanwu. He was building a people for himself, and he was feeding well. If he was sometimes lonely as his people lived out their brief lives, he was at least not bored. Short-lived people, people who could die, did not know what enemies loneliness and boredom could be. There was a large, low, yellow brick farmhouse at the edge of town for Doro, an ex-Dutch farmhouse that was more comfortable than handsome. Jonathan Wheatley's manor house was much finer, as was his mansion in New York City, but Doro was content with his farmhouse. In a good year, he might visit it twice. An English couple lived in Doro's house, caring for it and serving Doro when he was at home. They were a farmer, Robert Cutler, and his wife, youngest of the 9 Wheatley daughters, Sarah. These were sturdy, resilient people who had raised Isaac through his worst years. The boy had been difficult and dangerous during his adolescent years as his abilities matured. Doro had been surprised that the couple survived. Lael's foster parents had not. But then, Lael had been actively malevolent. Isaac had done harm only by accident. Also, neither of Lael's foster parents had been Wheatleys. Sarah's work with Isaac had proved again the worth of her kind. People with too little ability to be good breeding stock or food. It occurred to Doro that if his breeding projects were successful, there might come a time, in the far future, when he had to make certain such people continued to exist. Able people, but not so powerful that their ability might turn on them and cripple or kill them. For now, though, it was his witches who had to be protected, even protected from him. Anyanwu, for instance. He would tell her tonight that she was to marry Isaac. In telling her, he would have to treat her not as ordinary recalcitrant wild seed, but as one of his daughters. Difficult, but worth taking time with. Worth molding and coercing with more gentleness and patience than he would bother to use on less valuable people. He would talk to her after one of Sarah's good meals when they were alone in his room, warm and comfortable before a fire. He would do all he could to make her obey and live. He thought about her, worried about her stubbornness as he walked toward home where she waited. He had just placed Okoye and Udenkwo in a home with a middle-aged pair of their countrymen, people from whom the young couple could learn a great deal. He walked slowly, answering the greetings of people who recognized his current body and worrying about the pride of one small, forest peasant. People sat outside, men and women, Dutch fashion, gossiping on the stoops. The women's hands were busy with sewing or knitting, while the men smoked pipes. Isaac got up from a bench where he had been sitting with an older woman and fell into step with Doro.
"Annika is near her transition," the boy said worriedly. "Mrs. Waymans says she's been having a lot of trouble."
"That's to be expected," Doro answered. Annika Stryker was one of his daughters, a potentially good daughter. With luck, she would replace Lael when her transition was complete and her abilities mature. She lived now with her foster mother, Margaret Waymans, a big, physically powerful, mentally stable widow of 50. No doubt, the woman needed all her resources to handle the young girl now. Isaac cleared his throat.
"Mrs. Waymans is afraid she'll do something to herself. She's been talking about dying."
Doro nodded. Power came the way a child came, with agony. People in transition were open to every thought, every emotion, every pleasure, every pain from the minds of others. Their heads were filled with a continuous screaming jumble of mental noise. There was no peace, little sleep, many nightmares, everyone's nightmares. Some of Doro's best people, too many of them, stopped at this stage. They could pass their potential on to their children if they lived long enough to have any, but they could not benefit from it themselves. They could never control it. They became hosts for Doro, or they became breeders. Doro brought them mates from distant unrelated settlements, because that kind of crossbreeding most often produced children like Lael. Only great care and fantastic good luck produced a child like Isaac. Doro glanced at the boy fondly.
"I'll see Annika first thing tomorrow," he told him.
"Good," Isaac said with relief. "That will help. Mrs. Wayman says she calls for you sometimes when the nightmares come."
He hesitated.
"How bad will it get for her?"
"As bad as it was for you and for Lael."
"My God," Isaac said. "She's only a girl. She'll die."
"She has as much of a chance as you and Lael did."
Isaac glared at Doro in sudden anger.
"You don't care what happens to her, do you? If she does die, there will always be someone else."
Doro turned to look at him, and after a moment, Isaac looked away.
"Be a child out here if you like," Doro told him. "But act your age when we go in. I'm going to settle things between you and Anyanwu tonight."
"Settle? You're finally going to give her to me?"
"Think of it another way. I want you to marry her."
The boy's eyes widened. He stopped walking, leaned against a tall maple tree.
You've made up your mind, I suppose. I mean, you're sure that's what you want?
Of course. Doro stopped beside him.
Have you told her?
Not yet. I'll tell her after dinner.
Doro, she's wild seed. She might refuse.
I know.
You might not be able to change her mind.
Doro shrugged. Worried as he was, it did not occur to him to share his concern with Isaac. Anyanwu would obey him, or she wouldn't. He longed to be able to control her with some refinement of Lael's power, but he could not, nor could Isaac.
If you can't reach her, Isaac said, if she just won't understand, let me try. Before you do anything else, let me try.
All right.
And don't make her hate me.
I don't think I could. She might come to hate me for a while, but not you.
Don't hurt her.
Not if I can help it.
Doro smiled a little, pleased by the boy's concern.
You like the idea, he observed. You want to marry her.
Yes, but I never thought you'd let me.
She'll be happier with a husband who does more than visit her once or twice a year.
You're going to leave me here to be a farmer?
Farm if you want to, or open a store, or go back to smithing. No one could handle that better than you. Do whatever you like. But I am going to leave you here, at least for a while. She'll need someone to help her fit in here when I'm gone.
God, Isaac said. Married.
He shook his head, then began to smile.
Come on.
Doro started toward the house.
No.
Doro looked back at him.
I can't see her until you tell her. Now that I know, I can't. I'll eat with Annika. She could use the company anyway.
Sarah won't think much of that.
I know.
Isaac glanced homeward guiltily.
Apologize for me, will you?
Doro nodded, turned, and went in to Sarah Cutler's linen-clothed, heavily laden table. Anyanwu watched carefully as the white woman placed first a clean cloth, then dishes and utensils on the long, narrow table at which the household was to eat. Anyanwu was glad that some of the food and the white people's ways of eating it were familiar to her from the ship. She could sit down and have a meal without seeming utterly ignorant. She could not have cooked the meal, but that would come too, in time. She would learn. For now, she merely observed and allowed the interesting smells to intensify her hunger. Hunger was familiar and good. It kept her from staring too much at the white woman, kept her from concentrating on her own nervousness and uncertainty in the new surroundings, kept her attention on the soup, thick with meat and vegetables, and the roast deer flesh, venison, the white woman had called it, and a huge fowl, a turkey. Anyanwu repeated the words to herself, reassured that they had become part of her vocabulary. New words, new ways, new foods, new clothing. She was glad of the cumbersome clothing, though, finally. It made her look more like the other women, black and white, whom she had seen in the village, and that was important. She had lived in enough different towns through her various marriages to know the necessity of learning to behave as others did. What was common in one place could be ridiculous in another and abomination in a third. Ignorance could be costly.
"How shall I call you?"
she asked the white woman. Doro had said the woman's name once, very quickly, in introduction, then hurried off on business of his own. Anyanwu remembered the name, Sarah Cutler, but was not certain she could say it correctly without hearing it again.
"Sarah Cutler,"
the woman said very distinctly,
Mrs. Cutler.
Anyanwu frowned, confused. Which was right?
Mrs. Cutler?
Yes, you say it well.
I am trying to learn.
Anyanwu shrugged.
I must learn. How do you say your name?
Anyanwu.
She said it very slowly, but still the woman asked,
Is that all one name?
Only one.
I have had others, but Anyanwu is best. I come back to it. Are the others shorter?
Mgafu. That is the name my mother gave me. And once I was called Atagbusi and honored by that name, I have been called...
Never mind.
The woman sighed, and Anyanwu smiled to herself. She had had to give 5 of her former names to Isaac before he shrugged and decided Anyanwu was a good name after all.
Can I help to do these things?
She asked. Sarah Cutler was beginning to put food on the table now.
No,
the woman said.
Just watch now. You'll be doing this soon enough.
She glanced at Anyanwu curiously. She did not stare, but allowed herself these quick, curious glances. Anyanwu thought they each probably had an equal number of questions about the other. Sarah Cutler asked,
Why did Doro call you Sun Woman?
Doro had taken to doing that affectionately when he spoke to her in English, though Isaac complained that it made her sound like an Indian.
Your word for my name is Sun, she answered. Doro said he would find an English name for me, but I did not want one. Now he makes English of my name.
The white woman shook her head and laughed.
You're more fortunate than you know. With him taking such an interest in you, I'm surprised you're not already Jane or Alice or some such.
Anyanwu shrugged.
He has not changed his own name. Why should he change mine?
The woman gave her what seemed to be a look of pity.
What is Cutler?
Anyanwu asked.
What it means?
Yes.
A cutler is a knife maker. I suppose my husband had ancestors who were knife makers. Here, taste this.
She gave Anyanwu a bit of something sweet and oily, fruit-filled, and delicious.
It is very good,
Anyanwu said. The sweet was unlike anything she had tasted before. She did not know what to say about it except the words of courtesy Doro had taught her.
Thank you. What is this called?
The woman smiled, pleased.
It's a kind of cake I have made before, special for Isaac and Doro's homecoming.
You said...
Anyanwu thought for a moment.
You said your husband's people were knife makers.
Cutler is his name?
Yes. Here a woman takes the name of her husband after marriage. I was Sarah Wheatley before I married.
Then Sarah is the name you keep for yourself?
Yes.
Shall I call you Sarah? Your own name?
The woman glanced at her sidelong.
Shall I call you Mbagafo?
She mispronounced it horribly.
If you like, but there are very many Mgafos. That name only tells the day of my birth.
Like Monday or Tuesday?
Yes. You have 7. We have only 4. Ike, Oye, Afo, Nkwo. People are often named for the day they were born.
Your country must be overflowing with people of the same name. Anyanwu nodded.
But many have other names as well.
I suppose Anyanwu really is better.
Yes.
Anyanwu smiled.
Sara is good too. A woman should have something of her own.
Doro came in then, and Anyanwu noted how the woman brightened. She had not been sad or grim before, but now years seemed to drop from her. She only smiled at him and said dinner was ready, but there was a warmth in her voice that had not been there before, in spite of all her friendliness. At some time, this woman had been wife or lover to Doro. Probably lover. There was still much fondness between them, though the woman was no longer young. Where was her husband? Anyanwu wondered. How was it that a woman here could cook for a man neither her kinsman nor in-law, while her husband probably sat with others in front of one of the houses and blew smoke out of his mouth? Then the husband came in, bringing two grown sons and a daughter, along with the very young, shy wife of one of the sons. The girl was slender and olive-skinned, black-haired and dark-eyed, and even to Anyanwu's eyes, very beautiful. When Doro spoke to her courteously, her answer was a mere moving of the lips. She would not look at him at all, except once when his back was turned. But the look she gave him then spoke as loudly as had Sarah Cutler's sudden brightening. Anyanwu blinked and began to wonder what kind of man she had. The women aboard the ship had not found Doro so desirable. They had been terrified of him. But these women of his people, was he like a cock among them, going from one hen to another? They were not, after all, his kinsmen or his friends. They were people who had pledged loyalty to him, or people he had bought as slaves. In a sense, they were more his property than his people. The men laughed and talked with him, but none presumed as much as Isaac had. All were respectful. And if their wives or sisters or daughters looked at Doro, they did not notice. Anyanwu strongly suspected that if Doro looked back, if he did more than look, they would make an effort not to notice that, either. Or perhaps they would be honored. Who knew what strange ways they practiced? But now, Doro gave his attention to Anyanwu. She was shy in this company, men and women together eating strange food and talking in a language she felt she spoke poorly and understood imperfectly. Doro kept making her talk, speaking to her of trivial things. "Do you miss the yams? There are none quite like yours here."
"It does not matter."
Her voice was like the young girl's, no more than a moving of the lips. She felt ashamed to speak before all these strangers. Yet she had always spoken before strangers, and spoken well. One had to speak well and firmly when people came for medicine and healing. What faith could they have in someone who whispered or bowed her head? Determinedly, she raised her head and ceased concentrating so intently on her soup. She did miss the yams. Even the strange soup made her long for an accompanying mound of pounded yam. But that did not matter. She looked around, meeting the eyes first of Sarah Cutler, then of one of Sarah's sons, and finding only friendliness and curiosity in both. The young man, thin and brown-haired, seemed to be about Isaac's age. Thought of Isaac made Anyanwu look around.
"Where is Isaac?"
she asked Doro.
"You said this was his home."
"He's with a friend," Doro told her. "He'll be in later."
"He'd better," Sarah said. "His first night back and he can't come home to supper?"
"He had reason," Doro told her, and she said nothing more.
But Anyanwu found other things to say, and she no longer whispered. She paid some attention to spooning up the soup, as the others did, and to eating the other meats and breads and sweets correctly with her fingers. People here ate more carefully than had the men aboard the ship. Thus, she ate more carefully. She spoke to the shy young girl and discovered that the girl was an Indian, a Mohawk. Doro had matched her with Blake Cutler because both had just a little of the sensitivity Doro valued. Both seemed pleased with the match. Anyanwu thought she would have been happier with her own match, with Doro, had her people been nearby. It would be good for the children of their marriage to know her world as well as Doro's, to be aware of a place where blackness was not a mark of slavery. She resolved to make her homeland live for them, whether Doro permitted her to show it to them or not. She resolved not to let them forget who they were. Then she found herself wondering whether the Mohawk girl would have preferred to forget who she was as the conversation turned to talk of war with Indians. The white people at the table were eager to tell Doro how, earlier in the year, praying Indians and a group of whites called French had stolen through the gates of a town west of Wheatley, a town with the unpronounceable name of Schenectady, and butchered some of the people there and carried off others. There was much discussion of this, much fear expressed, until Doro promised to leave Isaac in the village and leave one of his daughters, Annika, who would soon be very powerful. This seemed to calm everyone somewhat. Anyanwu felt that she had only half understood the dispute between so many foreign people, but she did ask whether Wheatley had ever been attacked. Doro smiled unpleasantly. "Twice by Indians," he said. "I happened to be here both times. We've had peace since that second attack 30 years ago."
"That's time enough for them to forget anything," Sarah said. "Anyway, this is a new war. French and praying Indians."
She shook her head in disgust.
"Papists," her husband muttered. "Bastards."
"My people could tell them what powerful spirits live here," whispered the Mohawk girl, smiling.
Doro looked at her, as though not certain whether she were serious, but she ducked her head. Anyanwu touched Doro's hand.
"You see," she said, "I told you you were a spirit."
Everyone laughed, and Anyanwu felt more comfortable among them. She would find out another time exactly what papists and praying Indians were and what their quarrel was with the English. She had had enough new things for one day. She relaxed and enjoyed her meal. She enjoyed it too much. After much eating and drinking, after everyone had gathered around the tall, blue-tiled parlor hearth for talking and smoking and knitting, she began to feel pain in her stomach. By the time the gathering broke up, she was controlling herself very closely lest she vomit up all the food she had eaten and humiliate herself before all these people. When Doro showed her room with its fireplace and its deep, soft down mattresses covering a great bed, she undressed and lay down at once. There, she discovered that her body had reacted badly to one specific food, a rich sweet that she knew no name for, but that she had loved. This, on top of the huge amount of meat she had eaten, had finally been too much for her stomach. Now, though, she controlled her digestion, soothed the sickness from her body. The food did not have to be brought up, only gotten used to. She analyzed slowly, so intent on her inner awareness that she appeared to be asleep. If someone had spoken to her, she would not have heard. Her eyes were closed. This was why she had waited, had not healed herself downstairs in the presence of others. Here, though, it did not matter what she did. Only Doro was present. Across the large room, sitting at a great wooden desk much finer than the one he had on the ship. He was writing, and she knew from experience that he would be making marks unlike those in any of his books.
"It's a very old language," he had told her once. "So old that no one living can read it."
"No one but you,"
she had said. And he had nodded and smiled.
"The people I learned it from stole me away into slavery when I was only a boy. Now they're all dead. Their descendants have forgotten the old wisdom, the old writing, the old gods. Only I remember."
She had not known whether she heard bitterness or satisfaction in his voice then. He was very strange when he talked about his youth. He made Anyanwu want to touch him and tell him that he was not alone in outliving so many things. But he also roused her fear of him, reminded her of his deadly difference. Thus, she said nothing. Now, as she lay still, analyzing, learning not only which food had made her ill, but which ingredient in that food, she was comfortably aware of Doro nearby. If he had left the room in complete silence, she would have known, would have missed him. The room would have become colder. It was milk that had sickened her. Animal milk.
These people cooked many things with animal milk. She covered her mouth with her hand. Did Doro know? But of course he did. How could he not? These were his people. Again, it required all her control to prevent herself from vomiting, this time from sheer revulsion. Anyanwu? She realized that Doro was standing over her between the long claws that could be closed to conceal the bed. And she realized that this was not the first time he had said her name. Still, it surprised her that she had heard him without his shouting or touching her. He had only spoken quietly. She opened her eyes, looked up at him. He was beautiful standing there with the light of candles behind him. He had stripped to the cloth he still wore sometimes when they were alone together. But she noticed this with only part of her mind. Her main thoughts were still of the loathsome things she had been tricked into doing, the consumption of animal milk.
"Why didn't you tell me?"
she demanded.
"What?"
he frowned, confused.
"Tell you what?"
"That these people were feeding me animal milk."
He burst into laughter. She drew back as though he had hit her.
"Is it a joke, then? Are the others laughing too now that I cannot hear?"
"Anyanwu." He managed to stop his laughter.
"I'm sorry," he told her. "I was thinking of something else or I wouldn't have laughed. But, Anyanwu, we all ate the same food."
"But why was some of it cooked with—"
"Listen, I know the custom among your people not to drink animal milk. I should have warned you, would have, if I had been thinking. No one else who ate with us knew the milk would offend you. I assure you, they're not laughing."
She hesitated. He was sincere. She was certain of that. It was a mistake, then. But still,
"These people cook with animal milk all the time?"
"All the time," Doro said. "And they drink milk. It's their custom. They keep some cattle especially for milking."
"Abomination," Anyanwu said with disgust.
"Not to them," Doro told her.
"And you will not insult them by telling them they are committing abomination."
She looked at him. He did not seem to give many orders, but she had no doubt that this was one. She said nothing.
"You can become an animal whenever you wish," he said. "You know there's nothing evil about animal milk."
"It is for animals," she said. "I am not an animal now. I did not just eat a meal with animals."
He sighed.
"You know, you must change to suit the customs here. You have not lived 300 years without learning to accept new customs."
"I will not have any more milk."
"You need not, but let others have theirs in peace."
She turned away from him. She had never in her long life lived among people who violated this prohibition.
"Anyanwu!"
"I will obey,"
she muttered, then faced him defiantly.
"When will I have my own house, my own cooking fire?"
"When you have learned what to do with them. What kind of meal could you cook now with foods you've never seen before? Sarah Cutler will teach you what you need to know. Tell her milk makes you sick, and she'll leave it out of what she teaches you."
His voice softened a little, and he sat down beside her on the bed.
"It did make you sick, didn't it?"
"It did. Even my flesh knows abomination."
"It didn't make anyone else sick."
She only glared at him. He reached under the blanket, rubbed her stomach gently. Her body was almost buried in the too-soft feather mattress.
"Have you healed yourself?" he asked.
"Yes, but with so much food, it took me a long time to learn what was making me sick."
"Do you have to know?"
"Of course. How can I know what to do for healing until I know what healing is needed and why?"
"I think I knew all the diseases and poisons of my people. I must learn the ones here."
"Does it hurt you, the learning?"
"Oh, yes.
But only at first. Once I learn it, it does not hurt again.
Her voice became bantering.
No, give me your hand again. You can touch me, even though I am well.
He smiled, and there was no more tension between them. His touches became more intimate.
That is good, she whispered. I healed myself just in time. Now lie down here and show me why all those women were looking at you.
He laughed quietly, untied his cloth, and joined her in the too soft bed.
We must talk tonight, he said later, when both were satiated and lying side by side.
Do you still have strength for talking, husband?
She said drowsily.
I thought you would go to sleep and not awaken until sunrise.
No.
There was no humor in his voice now. She had laid her head on his shoulder because he had shown her in the past that he wanted her near him, touching him until he fell asleep. Now, though, she lifted her head and looked at him.
You've come to your new home, Anyanwu.
I know that.
She did not like the flat strangeness of his tone. This was the voice he used to frighten people, the voice that reminded her to think of him as something other than a man.
You are home, but I will be leaving again in a few weeks.
But
I will be leaving. I have other people who need me to rid them of enemies or who need to see me to know they still belong to me. I have a fragmented people to hunt and reassemble. I have women in 3 different towns who could bear powerful children if I give them the right mates, and more, much more.
She sighed and burrowed deeper into the mattress. He was going to leave her here among strangers. He had made up his mind.
When you come back, she said resignedly, there will be a son for you here.
Are you pregnant now?
I can be now. Your seed still lives inside me.
No!
She jumped, startled at his vehemence.
This is not the body I want to beget your first children here, he said.
She made herself shrug, speak casually.
All right. I'll wait until you have become another man.
You need not. I have another plan for you.
The hairs at the back of her neck began to prickle and itch.
What plan?
I want you to marry, he said. You'll do it in the way of the people here, with a license and a wedding.
It makes no difference. I will follow your custom.
Yes, but not with me.
She stared at him, speechless. He lay on his back, staring at one of the great beams that held up the ceiling.
You'll marry Isaac, he said. I want children from the 2 of you, and I want you to have a husband who does more than visit you now and then. Living here, you could go for a year, 2 years, without seeing me. I don't want you to be that alone.
Isaac? She whispered. Your son?
My son. He's a good man. He wants you. And I want you with him.
He's a boy. He's...
What man is not a boy to you except me? Isaac is more a man than you think.
But he's your son. How can I have the son when his father, my husband, still lives? That is abomination.
Not if I command it.
You cannot! It is abomination!
You have left your village, Anyanwu, and your town, and your land, and your people. You are here, where I rule. Here, there is only one abomination. Disobedience. You will obey.
I will not. Wrong is wrong. Something's changed from place to place, but not this. If your people wish to debase themselves by drinking the milk of animals, I will turn my head. Their shame is their own, but now you want me to shame myself, make myself even worse than they. How can you ask it of me, Doro? The land itself will be offended. Your crops will wither and die.
He made a sound of disgust.
That's foolishness. I thought I had found a woman too wise to believe such nonsense.
You have found a woman who will not soil herself. How is it here? Do sons lie with their mothers also? Do sisters and brothers lie down together?
Woman, if I command it, they lie down together gladly.
Anyanwu moved away from him so that no part of her body touched his. He had spoken of this before, of incest, of mating her own children together with dog-like disregard for kinship. And in revulsion, she had led him quickly from her land. She had saved her children, but now, who would save her?
I want children of your body and his, Dora repeated.
He stopped, raised himself to his elbow so that he leaned over her.
Sun woman, would I tell you to do something that would hurt my people? The land is different here. It is my land. Most of the people here exist because I caused their ancestors to marry in ways your people would not accept. Yet everyone lives well here. No angry god punishes them. Their crops grow and their harvests are rich every year.
And some of them hear so much of the thoughts of others that they cannot think their own thoughts. Some of them hang themselves.
Some of your own people hang themselves.
Not for such terrible reasons.
Nevertheless, they die.
Anyanwu, obey me. Life can be very good for you here, and you will not find a better husband than my son.
She closed her eyes, dismissed his pleading as she had his commands. She strove to dismiss her budding fear also, but she could not. She knew that when both commanding and pleading failed, he would begin to threaten. Within her body, she killed his seed. She disconnected the two small tubes through which her own seed traveled to her womb. She had done this many times when she thought she had given a man enough children. Now she did it, to avoid giving any children at all, to avoid being used. When it was done, she sat up and looked down at him.
"You have been telling me lies from the day we met,"
she said softly. He shook his head against the pillow.
"I have not lied to you."
"Let me give you children who will live,"
you said.
"I promise that if you come with me, I will give you children of your own kind,"
you said.
"And now you send me away to another man? You give me nothing at all."
"You will bear my children as well as Isaac's,"
she cried out as though with pain, and climbed out of his bed.
"Get me another room,"
she hissed.
"I will not lie there with you. I would rather sleep on the bare floor. I would rather sleep on the ground."
He lay still, as though he had not heard her.
"Sleep wherever you wish," he said after a while.
She stared at him, her body shaking with fear and anger.
"What is it you would make of me, Doro? Your dog? I cared for you. It has been lifetimes since I cared as much for a man."
He said nothing. She stepped nearer to the bed, looked down into his expressionless face, pleading herself now. She did not think it was possible to move him by pleading once he had made up his mind, but so much was at stake. She had to try.
"I came here to be a wife to you," she said. "But there were always others to cook for you, others to serve you in nearly all the ways of a wife. And if there had not been others, I know so little of this place that I would have performed my duties poorly. You knew it would be this way for me, but still you wanted me. And I wanted you enough to begin again like a child, completely ignorant."
She sighed and looked around the room, feeling as though she were hunting for the words that would reach him. There was only the alien furniture, the desk, the bed, the great wooden cabinet beside the door. A kas, it was called, a Dutch thing for storing clothing. There were two chairs and several mats, rugs of heavy, colorful cloth. It was all as alien as Doro himself. It gave her a feeling of hopelessness, as though she had come to this strange place only to die. She stared into the fire in the fireplace, the only familiar thing in the room,
and spoke softly.
Husband, it may be a good thing that you're going away. A year is not so long, or 2 years, not to us. I have been alone before for many times that long. When you come back, I will know how to be a wife to you here. I will give you strong sons.
She turned her eyes back to him, saw that he was watching her.
Do not cast me aside before I show you what a good wife I can be.
He sat up, put his feet on the floor.
You don't understand, he said softly.
He pulled her down to sit beside him on the bed.
Haven't I told you what I'm building? Over the years, I've taken people with so little power they were almost ordinary, and bred them together again and again, until in their descendants small abilities grew large, and a man like Isaac could be born. And a man like Lael. Lael wasn't as bad as he seemed. He handled what ability he had very well, and I've created others of his kind who had more ability and a better temperament.
Did you create him, then? From what? Mounds of clay?
Anyanwu.
Isaac tells me the whites believe their god made the first people of clay. You talk as though you think you were that god.
He drew a deep breath, looked at her sadly.
What I am or think I am need not concern you at all. I've told you what you must do.
No, be quiet.
Hear me.
She closed her mouth, swallowed a new protest.
I said you didn't understand, he continued. Now I think you're deliberately misunderstanding. Do you truly believe I mean to cast you aside because you've been a poor wife?
She looked away. No, of course she did not believe that. She had only hoped to reach him, make him stop his impossible demands. No, he was not casting her aside for any reason at all. He was merely breeding her as one bred cattle and goats. He had said it. I want children of your body and his. What she wanted meant nothing. Did one ask a cow or a nanny goat whether it wished to be bred? I am giving you the very best of my sons, he told her. I expect you to be a good wife to him. I would never send you to him if I thought you couldn't. She shook her head slowly.
It is you who have not understood me.
She gazed at him, at his very ordinary eyes, at his long, handsome face. Until now, she had managed to avoid a confrontation like this by giving in a little, obeying. Now she could not obey.
You are my husband, she said quietly, or I have no husband. If I need another man, I will find one. My father and all my other husbands are long dead. You gave no gifts for me. You can send me away, but you cannot tell me where I must go.
Of course I can.
His quiet calm matched her own, but in him it was clearly resignation.
You know you must obey, Anyanwu. Must I take your body and get the children I want from it myself? You cannot.
Within herself, she altered her reproductive organs further, made herself literally no longer a woman, but not quite a man, just to be certain.
You may be able to push my spirit from my body, she said. I think you can, though I have never felt your power.
But my body will give you no satisfaction. It would take too long for you to learn to repair all the things I have done to it, if you can learn. It will not conceive a child now. It will not live much longer itself without me to keep watch on it.
She could not have missed the anger in his voice when he spoke again.
You know I will collect your children if I cannot have you.
She turned her back on him, not wanting him to see her fear and pain, not wanting her own eyes to see him. He was a loathsome thing. He came to stand behind her, put his hands on her shoulders. She struck them away violently.
Kill me,
she hissed.
Kill me now,
but never touch me that way again.
And your children? He said, unmoved.
No child of mine would commit the abominations you want, she whispered.